Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Forrest Stevens Show. Today, we are talking with Joe Soul, and he is a veteran of the U.S. Army. He enlisted after 9/11. I mean, you're going to hear the whole rundown of his story, which is incredibly interesting, but he was deployed to Iraq, and now he's come back. He's become an author, and he's told his story of being over there and how he's gone actually from being somebody who was really wrapped up in the whole thing that happened after 9/11, you know, the whole fervor for blood, and how he went from that, being involved in that, to becoming a pacifist, and how he's worked on himself with the help of psychedelic assisted therapy. And yeah, we just get into that entirely interesting conversation. So that's coming right up after this ad. If you've been enjoying this podcast for a while, I know that you're going to enjoy this next thing that I'm talking about, which is my book. It's called Tripping. And this book and the podcast are definitely interconnected. And sometimes in this podcast, on the solo episodes, I'll actually just open up this book to a random page, read it out, and talk about what it kind of brings to mind or how it was formulated and thought out. These pages aren't full, so this can be kind of a journal type thing where my paragraph in here is a jumping off point. It's a new thought, and it will spark creativity within your own mind, and you can add to it in your own way. Now, that's what I do on the podcast sometimes. And a little bit about this book. It is available on Amazon as a paperback. I highly recommend it as a paperback, as that trip companion, as that journal. And you can just randomly flip to it, or you can read it through and kind of just gain some insights and some nice jumping off points for yourself. But this book was written over a year of my life, a life in isolation and doing intense yoga every single day for over an hour, breath work, and combining that with different psychedelics, predominantly cannabis, and writing down the thoughts that came to my mind. Then I filtered through those thoughts and those writings and edited them up a little bit so that they were concise and that they would create a new thought in your mind. That's the goal of this book. And I hope that it will be interesting. And so far, a lot of people who have bought it have said that it's been really, really awesome. So, I mean, that's that's good for them. And I think if you enjoy this podcast, like I said, just to wrap it all up, if you enjoy this podcast, you will definitely enjoy this book. It's available in the description below. Recommend getting the paperback. It is available on Kindle as well. Thanks, everyone.
I am an Iraq War veteran. I'm an author. And I wrote a book called The Broken Mirror of Memory. It's Iraq and Other Tales. So it's my journey from joining after September 11th to the deserts of Iraq to realizing that I did not support the war in principle, and finishing my time, getting out, becoming a peace activist, and also using psychedelics for healing.
Okay, so there's a lot to get in there. We'll start at the beginning of that, though. You mentioned you joined in what part of the military were you in?
I was in the Army for 8 years.
Okay, so you joined the Army after 9/11. Was 9/11 the sort of the catalyst for you to join?
Yes, it was the catalyst for me, and I was very angry about it and wanted to do something about it. And then when I volunteered for a mobilization, I didn't know where it was to, and I ended up in Iraq and realized Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and we had been basically lied to into stealing their oil wealth, essentially. And there I was, and I couldn't leave, and I had to do my job, so I did my job.
And how long were you over there in Iraq for?
I was there for 13 months.
13 months. Okay. And did you have any inkling of joining the military before 9/11? Like, was that a possibility for you?
I came from a military family, so it was a possibility, but it wasn't the only thing I was considering. Then after 9/11, I was in high school during 9/11. I hadn't graduated yet. So I waited and waited and waited and then joined in 2006.
Right. Oh, okay. So you waited a while. What made you wait?
I had to finish high school first.
Oh, right.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I feel like, you know, I'm Canadian. So looking in, and I was quite young when 9/11 happened as well. You know, 2001, how old was I? I was 6, 7, I guess. So quite young. I do remember it happening. It was such a massive world event. But I feel like kind of looking in and what I know now about it a little bit, it was a massive deal for the public in America. It really, I mean, that was the first time America got attacked since Pearl Harbor, right? And I think it created a lot of fear and a lot of kind of emotion for a lot of people. You know, it was like, it was in a sense the big reason for going and invading the countries, right? And you mentioned there, you know, kind of Iraq not really having anything to do with it, and there was this premise of WMDs and all this. I mean, it looking at the wars that ensued after that, I mean, it's such a complicated thing. But to go back to my main point here, it sort of seemed to, I don't know if this is the right term, but it sort of began to radicalize people into the idea of getting involved in conflict. Can you just talk a little bit more on that for yourself?
Oh, there was a bloodlust in the country after 9/11. Everyone was so pissed off, and Afghanistan in that context was the good war, where the people who attacked us actually were. And then Iraq was the bad war during the aftermath of, you know, that decade after 9/11. You know, Iraq became the bad war. Afghanistan was the good war. I realized pretty early on in my tour in Iraq that there really was no good war. And I became opposed to all war. And that's part of the reason why I wrote the book, to get even a single veteran story out there that says, hey guys, maybe we should stop killing each other. I mean, it's interesting that the United States has invaded Canada twice and Mexico once. We've invaded both our neighbors. I'm sure you know a little bit about the American invasions during the Revolution and the War of 1812. We really wanted that land up north. It looked good. The land down south looked good as well. So we see the United States has a history of imperialist adventures, and I would like to see those ended. I would like to see us become more like the United Kingdom or Canada, where we don't really get terribly involved in foreign wars. I know, you know, the UK and Canada are both part of NATO, so we definitely get involved. We're certainly not, you know, they're certainly not perfect countries, but you don't see Canada invading countries unilaterally. And that's something I respect greatly about Canada. That and the maple syrup. I really appreciate that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You got to appreciate the maple syrup. I guess, you know, this is more looking at current events now, but do you see any parallels and with the war in Ukraine right now with any of the involvement that you had in the military, or any of the kind of just looking back at the history of Afghanistan and Iraq, do you see any parallels or any differences or anything interesting there for you?
I see great differences in Russia's open brutality. If you look at the war crimes in Bucha, for instance, it's brutality on a scale that I don't think we've seen since the Second World War. But then you look at the American invasion of Fallujah in 2004, and you think there was quite a lot of brutality there as well. I think they're comparable in principle, in that they are both, Iraq and Ukraine are both illegal wars of aggression. I found it interesting when they brought Vladimir Putin up on charges of crimes against peace, essentially, through the ICC, but no one's brought George Bush up on charges. That's why I find the Trump indictments, plural, so interesting. Is, yes, Trump is, in my opinion, an asshole. I think he's a jerk, okay? But do the crimes he committed rise to the level of the crimes George W. Bush committed? I don't believe so. And yet we haven't seen that George W. Bush indictment. And that's something I'm still waiting for, either through the ICC or through an American court or through a foreign court. I've been waiting for that for quite a long time, and I think I'll be waiting quite a lot longer, if not for the rest of my life. I don't see it happening. But yes, I do see parallels between Iraq and Ukraine in the legality of the invasion itself.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. It's like, I mean, I guess there's these kind of global laws of what is like a lawful war or an unlawful. But these distinctions are kind of interesting. It's like, when is it okay to go and kill people in another country? You know, like, I don't know, you know?
It's really hard. I think for me, the only just war really is when your country is invaded and you have to fight off the invaders, right? That would be the only time when they're on your soil and you have to fight them off. That's the only time when a war, I believe, could be called justified, or you're specifically attacked, your civilians are attacked, you have to respond. I would prefer we don't respond to violence with violence. I would prefer humanity gets away from this culture of accepting that, oh, we make large bombs that kill other human beings and maim other human beings. I would, as a person who worked in munitions in a war zone and gave out those bombs every day, I would prefer that we didn't blow up our fellow human beings. I think we can start there as a basis. If we shift our paradigm, if we change our view of things, if we change our society to one based upon compassion and love rather than competition and violence, we might find we have less wars. But the powerful people don't seem to want that, do they?
Well, yeah, that's one thing that came to my mind was there is this industry behind war, and a lot of times people will blame that industry, you know, the military-industrial complex. They'll say there's a profit incentive. I mean, you mentioned getting oil out of Iraq. There seems to be people or corporations or I mean, even politicians to some degree will benefit from certain wars. There's a lot there, but I did also want to get into, because what you've been talking about now is definitely your opinion now, but going back to 2006, I mean, and you talked about that transformation that you've had into becoming more of a pacifist. You must not have thought this way back in 2006 to have joined in the army.
No. One of the chapters, it's called in the book, The Broken Mirror of Memory, it's called A Soldier's Education. And it's something that I loved at the time. We were on the bayonet course during our bayonet training, and we all, spaced apart at intervals, had our bayonets fixed, and we would yell, "To kill, to kill, to kill without mercy, to kill, to kill, to kill without regret, kill the women, kill the children. What makes the grass grow? Blood, blood, bright red blood." This is the basis of military training, to instill upon you a desire to kill. Every time we were called to attention in basic training, we would yell, "Kill!" Killing is, it's an intimate part of the military profession. And the fact that we're spending so many millions of dollars upon instilling those values into soldiers, into young men and women who are very impressionable, by the way, and they all believe they're invincible, at least when they start. And then you send them into a war zone where there's rules of engagement, right? There's you don't harm civilians, you don't kill civilians. We did our best to avoid killing civilians. I will say that. The U.S. military holds a high standard to that, but mistakes are made. In the training, however, the cadence is like, I went to the local market where all the women shopped. I pulled out my machete and I began to chop. I went to the local playground where all the children play. I pulled out my Uzi and I began to spray. These are cadences you sing while marching. So it's illegal. It's stated in training, you can't kill civilians, but there's an undercurrent of let's encourage killing. So at the time, I was into killing the enemy. I wanted to go fight. I was angry about 9/11. I wanted to go fight. And then that evolution happened where I said, wait a minute, these are fellow human beings. Why would I want to harm my fellow human beings? That's not the values I was raised on. That's something entirely different. But yet it's glorified. And that transition happened over years. I started becoming a pacifist while I was in Iraq, and that's where a lot of my guilt comes from. Every casualty that was in southern Iraq that was at the hands of U.S. forces, mostly accidental in the case of civilians and intentional in the case of enemy combatants, I hold some responsibility for, because I worked at the main ammunition supply point for southern Iraq. So I hold that responsibility in myself. That's why I have to argue for peace now, and that's what I do in the book. Because we have to change our paradigm. We have to change our way of thinking, our view, so that we can avoid these conflicts in the future. I mean, it benefits no one. Except for the very rich, of course.
So you said that transformation happened over years. What did that look like? How did that start? What were some of the kind of the key moments or catalysts that began that transformation in a meaningful way?
It started when I went to Iraq and I started realizing, hey, the things that the left-wing activists are saying about this war are true. They're correct. For example, in Iraq, I worked as an escort. I worked escorting Iraqi workers to build up our bases, our ammunition supply point. I can't get into the designs of those, but they also built fence lines for us to increase security around the ammunition supply point. And there were children filling sandbags who looked as young as 10. So when you consider the American military using child labor under armed guard, it starts not looking so good. And I didn't like that. I started feeling guilty about that. So I was as nice to the workers as possible. I became known as a Haji lover for that. That's what they called it. I was a Haji lover. That's what we called the enemy. They were all Haji. It's sort of an overarching cultural thing within the military to dehumanize the enemy. So that was the dehumanizing word we used for them. And that started my evolution, actually meeting with the Iraqi people, sitting with them, eating with them. And I talk a lot about that in the book. The first section is called Conversations with Ali. And Ali was my translator. And he was the person that personified the people of Iraq to me and made me realize, hey, I have no quarrel with these people whatsoever. As a matter of fact, Ali's a really nice guy. You know, he brings me, some Iraqi soda and some flatbread and some delicious lamb, some really wonderful food. He shows me pictures of his family. I make sure that I get vitamins from the PX so that his son can get the vitamins he needs, because he's not necessarily getting all the nutrition that he needs. It's a very poor family. And I realized that instead of being a soldier, I have to be a human being. And those two are diametrically opposed. There's no real way to be both. So the human being started growing out of the soldier and has now completely overgrown it. But if you think of it like a tree, the human being is the tree. And it's overshadowing the soil and the undergrowth. The soldier is still the undergrowth. You cannot remove it. For me, it's the foundation. And it's an identity that's impossible to wash off, and I talk about that in the book as well. You simply can't wash it off, but you can grow from it and become something new in the soil of the old.
So is that because it got so instilled, that identity or that part of you?
It's so instilled that, well, I don't do it now, but I usually keep my hair very short you know, the same way I always did. I'm usually clean shaven, as we always were in the military. It's instilled in the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you think. You never really get out. At least a lot of people don't. You never really, because it's 9 weeks of intense brainwashing, for lack of a better term. It's really what it is. And once you've been instilled with those values, once you've taken the Army values as your own, you don't wash them off. It's something that is not just a job. It's a life experience. It's something that's core to your personality, to your being, and it takes a lot of work to remove those things from yourself, if that's something you want to do. Not everybody does. I say in the book that, you know, if you feel guilt from the war, talking to the, you know, people in my unit or the people who have served who may pick up the book, if you feel guilt from the war, then you have to deal with that in any way that you want to deal with that, including no way at all, if that's your choice. If you feel nothing, or if you think that it was right, then you don't have to do anything for yourself. But me, I have to remove it from myself. I have to take it out, because there's something inherently wrong with the killing of other human beings and the occupations of their countries that really needs to be addressed if we want to move forward as a species. It's a very serious issue. And everyone seems to have forgotten about the war. They've moved on to the war in Ukraine now, and now we're supporting the Ukrainians against the Russians. I think the Ukrainians' cause is just. I think the Russians' cause is unjust. I feel bad for the civilian suffering, but I also feel bad for the Russian conscripts that are suffering, because they got drafted. They don't necessarily want to be there either. And you have to think, God, those poor kids. All for a few, a few inches of land. Because the front is a World War I style front, and they're dying for a few inches of land this way and a few inches of land that way. It truly is a crime against humanity. Warfare in general is truly a crime against humanity.
I agree. There's a lot I want to get to there. One of them, I want to talk a little bit about I'm curious to know if, when you were maybe before you went to Iraq or in Iraq, did they talk about wanting to help the people of Iraq? And did you see, and because you kind of saw contradictory evidence to that, but I'm curious if that was part of the selling point of your work over there, was helping the Iraqi people.
There was a idea of helping within the frame of winning hearts and minds, to ensuring that we win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people so that they don't contribute to the insurgency. And there were genuine people in the army. Not everyone in there is this vicious killer. The military is full of idealists, and I talk about that in the book, of people who really want to do a lot of good. And there are soldiers who firmly believe in the mission, who firmly believe in the army, who are straight down the line, straight-laced folks who genuinely do good for the people that they are serving amongst. And we built schools, we built, hospitals, we built roads. We also blew a lot of them up because, war is like that. But there was an attempt to do good by those people. But I believe on the highest levels, not on the individual level of soldier to civilian, soldier to Iraqi, there was a genuine compassion that these person to person wanted to do a good deed. On the macro level, where we have the overarching military industrial complex and our political leaders, they were doing it so that we could win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. And in many cases in the Sunni areas, they actually paid cash money to have people join these awakening councils so that they wouldn't join the insurgency and attack us. We paid them not to attack us, and it worked. And it stabilized a lot of the country. So by the time I got there in 2008, there was a lull in violence. That violence could reach in. We lost 3 U.S. soldiers my first week in country. They were killed in a rocket attack. And I remember that attack in my nightmares, but it's so broken up that it took me until about a year ago talking with members of my unit, who were all good, decent human beings, by the way, who did their job, followed their orders, but did their best to be compassionate at the same time. I have nothing bad to say about the people in my unit. I have that loyalty to them, and I always will. But I talked to them. I talked to my former commander, my former first sergeant, my former squad leader, several other soldiers, and they said, yeah, we were there for that, by the way, when those 3 guys got killed. I said, no, we weren't. No, we weren't. Not at all. Couldn't be. Couldn't be. I had blacked it from my memory. I had gone, nope, not going there. Completely blocked it off. And that's why the book is called The Broken Mirror of Memory. Because all the pieces of my tour, all the time in Iraq, is so broken up. It's like picking up pieces of a broken mirror and trying to find the memory in the reflection. It's very difficult. We had 10 casualties while I was there at that base. And I now, in my present state, my present incarnation, I remember all of them. For a while, I only remembered 7. And that's the weird thing about the fog of war. I don't know why. My VA therapist says a traumatic experience, you can block it from your memory, and that's apparently what happened. So it's sort of coming to terms with that is the new truth of my life, I guess, is coming to terms with that, coming to terms with being alive. I talk a lot about survivor's guilt in the book, and I'm still dealing with that. But really what I want to get out with this book and this story is that there are human beings who join idealistically, who suffer greatly, who just want to be normal again, and they simply can't. And they go on with their lives, they travel the country. I drove from New York to Washington, where I live now. I drove the whole country. I've taken a lot of magic mushrooms in therapeutic doses and sessions to try to remove some of the damage that has been done, and it's been quite successful, actually. I would advocate for their legalization, especially for medical purposes. And I talk a lot about the psychedelic trips in the book as well, and the things I realized from them. And I will stop rambling so you can ask a question.
Well, that was basically going to be my next question, was how you work through your, because you've talked about guilt. How do you work through your guilt and you've experienced trauma. So how do you work through your trauma? How do you work through your guilt? Maybe you can talk a little bit more about I would love to hear in depth about the things that you've learned from magic mushrooms, and yeah, just any other things that you found helpful or things you haven't found helpful. Just yeah, interested to hear.
You know, first, to deal with the trauma, I first wrote the book, and I will have a poem reading for you at some point during the podcast. It's frankly my favorite part of the book. But I dealt with my trauma first through writing, then through, well, I did about 10 years of heavy drinking. I talk a lot about heavy drinking in the book and alcoholism. I went to AA and got that sorted out. And I realized through psychedelic mushrooms and through LSD the oneness of the universe, the oneness of humanity, my own oneness with whatever this is, man, because we don't know what it is. It's very strange, isn't it? Isn't this existence a strange thing? It's very weird. It's very strange. And I was able to break through all the conventions, all the, you know, societal assumptions, all of the institutions, all of the things that we base our baseline upon, and feel a oneness with the universe that I didn't know was possible. And that was my first time tripping. And it changed. It really changed my entire perspective. It allowed me to expand compassion to all living beings, where before that was a Buddhist concept I had studied, but it wasn't something that I had truly experienced until psychedelic mushrooms. And I went, wow, we're all the same thing. You know, it's just like George Carlin said, you, me, and even a Coke machine or a cigarette butt in the streets of Buffalo, we're all the same thing. There's nothing out there that needs solace seeking. It's all us. But we've been separated by giving an identity and a name, and we feel separate. But I believe that psychedelic mushrooms allow our brains to unlock something that I'm not sure if we lock up ourselves, or as something that's simply on a deeper level without us having to do anything at all. But it allows us to experience the oneness, and the oneness is healing.
So in what way is it healing? So, first off, you said that you'd only kind of read about this idea in, Buddhist philosophy. And it's very interesting. I think there's a lot of things like that where it's like you can learn something, but you don't really know it until you experience it. So it's almost with that experience that it becomes like you unlock what it actually kind of means in a deeper sense.
Yeah, you definitely unlock it, by trying the magic mushrooms. That's not something I would encourage for everyone. You have to make sure you don't have any serious underlying mental health issues like a history of family schizophrenia, things of that nature. You want to be careful. And if you can, you want to do it in a clinical setting like I did. I was able to find, certain things in Oregon that were, very useful. But it really does open up the oneness. And it's not something you can really describe in words. You can try, and I certainly did. But it's something that you just have to experience. Once you experience the oneness, you can't go back. Once you feel that joy, you can't go back from that. It's something that I think rewires your brain.
And have you tried to get there without magic mushrooms at all?
Yes, I've tried several meditation techniques, and they get close, but I'm obviously not the Buddha, so I'm not a meditation expert. So for me, magic mushrooms was the thing that got me there.
Makes sense. I wanted to go back a little bit to you going into the AA community. There's a lot of kind of teachings throughout that, and just kind of a lot of like self-reflection that needs to happen, and kind of understanding who you are and why you have this addiction and all of that. Was it so? I'm assuming that had some sort of impact on you. Can you talk to me a little bit about the impact of AA?
Yeah, it really boils down to the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the wisdom to change the things I can, or yeah, I screwed it up, of course, because I'm on a podcast. But it really boils down to the serenity prayer. You just have to seek that serenity. And really what AA helped me realize is that I can't drink those people back to life. And I can't continue to try to drink myself to death because they're dead. I can't bring those soldiers back by doing 7 shots for them. I can't bring the 10 guys back by doing 10 shots for them. And I tried doing that for a good decade. I tried drinking them back to life. It doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. All it does is hurt you.
Do you think was the alcohol also like, it's very interesting. Like the alcohol does give you something, right? It gives you something to kind of lean on, or some way to forget, some numbing. Were you also like kind of leaning on it for something that you needed in your life?
No, I don't think there was any. In the beginning, perhaps I was leaning on it for a numbing agent. But in the long term, there was no benefit to it whatsoever. It simply made you sick. And when you're suicidal, but you don't have the cojones to go through with it, you just do it in slow motion instead. And I would say that while I quit drinking and that is no longer the way I'm trying to do it, I say to the clerk sometimes, especially when I'm in a really bad mood, "Hey man, can I get a pack of smokes?" "Yeah, what kind?" "Oh, well, I like my suicide in slow motion and menthol flavored." You know, we're not perfect beings, and you know, in a way, someone who is so addicted, and it certainly is that way with nicotine for me still, but thankfully not with alcohol, because alcohol may be a lot quicker, is that some addicts are really just trying to die. And that's exactly what I was trying to do. And once you realize that, you have to move beyond that and quit.
So what made you move beyond that feeling and wanting to, because like you needed that sense of wanting to be alive, right? What kind of sparked that for you?
Honestly, it was the mushroom trips. It was finally realizing that feeling of oneness. I was finally able to say, "Hey, there might be something positive to live for here." You know, there might be something positive to live for here. And psychedelics changed my life and got me away from alcohol. Psychedelics aren't something you have to do once a day, once a week, once a month, even once a year to have therapeutic benefits, in my opinion. I'm not a doctor, but and you end up a better person for them, even if you have a bad trip. There's no such thing as a bad trip. It's only your attitude towards it. It always teaches you something. And it's not something that is addictive. It's not something you will become addicted to, thankfully. It doesn't necessarily have those properties that alcohol certainly does. And some of the harder street drugs certainly do. And it offers so much benefit. So that's what got me away from alcohol, is the psychedelic mushroom trips and realizing I was one with the universe in the simplest way I can put it. Hey, there might be something to live for. It's all me out there. Everything's fine,
man. That's awesome, man. Yeah. You're not alone there. There's other people that have totally, you know, that's been the kind of an eye-opening experience to, I like to think about it as that's how you could live your life. Like, I don't know if we're designed to live as if we were tripping, you know, all day, 24/7, but it gives you a glimpse. It kind of like elevates, it takes you up in an elevator and lets you see a totally different existence. And then you leave that place, but you are still left. It leaves an impression, and it makes you, in my opinion, it has made me feel like, oh, that's possible. It's possible to live better. It's possible to feel more connected. It's possible to just feel that way.
That was a big thing for me that I talk about in the second half of the book. Healing through that. Really, the first half of the book is all about Iraq and alcoholism. It's Iraq and its aftermath, followed by the journey up. The journey up is dedicated to my mother. She died when I was 10. And my first experience with psychedelic mushrooms was really an attempt to contact her. I always felt the separation from her, and I didn't know her very well because I was a young child when she passed. She was very sick my whole life, blind, in a wheelchair. And I wanted to contact her. I thought, well, I'll give this a shot. Who knows? Maybe Joe Rogan's right and DMT is the way to go. But I haven't tried that yet. But it was all an attempt at both healing from Iraq and to contact my mother. But I can't say that I actually got in contact with her through magic mushrooms.
I wanted to go back a little bit again, back to your time in Iraq. When you started to feel like, okay, what are we doing here? Or some of the leftist activists are right about some of these things. Did you vocalize that with anybody there? Or how did the other people you were working with kind of feel about did you have a shift in mood? Or did you just kind of like, I got to keep it underline, you know, and just feel that underneath everything?
I mean, I let people know my opinion, but I did my job and I kept it as quiet as I could at the time.
And why was that? Why did you keep it quiet?
Because you get in trouble if you start questioning the war while you're in the middle of the war. You know, you have to toe the line. You have to do your job. You have to do your duty. It's not just a job, it's a contract. You sign a contract, so you have to fulfill that obligation. So it's something that some people in the group Iraq Veterans Against the War did not stay quiet about, and they got in quite a lot of trouble for that. They deserted, they went AWOL, they refused, they protested. I joined and stayed very quiet. I spoke, but I followed my orders.
Yeah, you towed the line, like you said. That makes sense, because I feel like it would be a very difficult place to be vocal about that.
Yeah, it's not the place you want to stand out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would love to hear, you mentioned you had a poem that you wrote. I would love to hear that if you want to share it.
So again, this is in the book, The Broken Mirror of Memory. It's called Stuck in My Boots. This is about a CH-47 crash. The mission name was Red River 44. We were, my unit and many other units came to their dignified transfer ceremony where they moved the caskets from the trucks to the planes. And you're out there in the middle of the night. It was unexpected, and it was something that had a great impact upon me, seeing those boxes go by. It says, stuck in my boots. I can't just put those men away in boxes. Sand whips by us, and it feels like a cold night. It must be 65 degrees. We stand erect at perfect attention. Our shadows are carried in boxes. They are men who we might not have liked in life. We don't even know their names at present. But there we stand, our bodies aching from holding that same hand salute. The flag-draped coffins, red, white, and blue. The chaplain offers prayer. How the fuck did we get here? I feel stuck in my boots and I want out. That should be me in that box and I know it. I can never live it down. I can't move. So I'll just stand here, saluting, on this tarmac, in the middle of the night, for the rest of my life. It's a place I've never left. And that led to a lot of the drinking. I'm still standing there. There are certain events in your life that you literally can't leave. You'll be there forever. And that was certainly one of them.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful, man. Incredibly powerful. Wow. I'm speechless. What do you think, you know, you're not alone with that. I think that there's going to be a lot of people who feel the same way as you, who have come out of military service or maybe are coming out of military service. What do you think is something that's helpful for them as they kind of try to get back to whatever sense of normal that they can now?
Finding that sense of purpose. Sorry, I have a guinea pig.
That's okay.
I'm just very excited right now. Finding that sense of purpose, finding something you can hold on to, finding something that you can truly believe in, finding a project that's therapeutic for you. That's where the healing comes from.
I think that's just generally good advice for anybody, you know, having a purpose in life and having something that drives you forward is just ultimately so important. For some reason, that's how we're wired as humans. We have to have something to do. And if we don't, we start to kind of decay in our brains and it becomes not good.
Yeah. A lot of folks who end up on VA disability, I have friends that I don't want to speak ill of them because they're such good people, but I feel like a lot of folks who get on 100% VA disability, they end up stagnating because they have that money, then they have no purpose, then they feel lost. And you got to have a hobby, man. You got to have something. You got to have a project. And that's really what the book became for me. Of course, now it's promoting the book. And I would implore anyone who listens to this, anyone who, you know, comes by and sees this at any point, it's available on Amazon. I would implore them to check it out. It's a reasonably priced book. It's only $14.95, and it's literally my life's work. It's something that I feel has a lot of value, and something I feel might change their perspective on war, on human nature, on our interactions with others, on our society in general. It's something that is a beloved project, and I would be honored if you picked it up.
It's linked in the description. It's called The Broken Mirror of Memory, Iraq and Other Tales by Joseph Soul. Is that how your last name is pronounced? All right. Yeah, it's linked in the description. Yeah, highly recommend checking it out. And yeah, thanks so much for your time today, Joe. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. How much time do we have left?
We can go a little bit more if you have some more to share.
Sure. I have a piece called The Broken Mirror of Memory.
All right.
Iraq was an experience that I carry with me into the world. It is a world that seems indifferent to the experience of veterans. Most people would prefer to forget the war, pretend it never happened, and move on. A veteran does not have that option. We must sit in it every day, in one way or another. As I sit in a coffee shop writing, people are going about their lives. Am I going about my life? My sleep is often disturbed and I find no rest. I don't really know what's worse, though. Is it lack of sleep or writer's block? Does anyone want a memoir of someone they have never heard of, anyway? What we put into the world is so fragile, it feels it can break with the slightest gust of wind. Presenting our truth to the world can be an extremely painful thing that is all too often void of the appreciation of others. Writing is both a passion and a curse. Those who have not written think that writing comes naturally. However, we are still lost in the mirage. The sandstorm still rages in our mind's eye, and we have no sense of direction. Perhaps the time I can see Iraq clearly are the most terrifying. When the demons come in the night, I must face them, and there is no escape. I can hear the screaming, smell the smoke, even if I cannot remember it in the waking world. If I could write my nightmare in detail, I would have a few pages more to add. All I have is broken up reflections from the shattered mirror of the past. I can remember going to the visitor control center to pick up Iraqi workers. It was part of their normal workday to be searched by armed men, to have their vehicle searched and inspected at the entry point, and to go to work for the army occupying their country. I can remember the rocket attacks, smoke and flame 200 meters outside the living area. I can remember a rough night when 7 soldiers were killed in a CH-47 crash and watching their flag-draped caskets going by. I can remember running along that same flight line for morning PT. The same flight line where the 7 men killed were sent home to Dover Air Force Base. I can remember a briefing about explosively formed projectiles, IEDs. I recall one about the insurgents possibly using chemical warheads. After that one, I seem to remember carrying a gas mask for a while. Those warheads never came. I can recall a convoy operations briefing where I was briefed on my mission outside the Ryer, rolling down the main supply route, past rundown villages, my sergeant pointing out the window and ensuring I was keeping an eye out for IEDs and RPG teams. I remember looking out the dusty window, searching for anything out of the ordinary that might be an explosive device, a wire, trash, a hint of danger. The kids ran up to us when we stopped, and of course we gave them little presents. I tried to imagine living my childhood in their shoes. After a split second of that, it was back to scanning for snipers. I was told they often aim for the throat, as our femoral arteries were unprotected by our body armor. The village across the river seemed peaceful enough. A woman washed her laundry at the riverbank, and the kids played nearby. I noticed satellite TV dishes on the tops of the mud brick single-story buildings. I saw the school we had built for the Iraqi children, many of whom worked on the base under my guard. I had talked to the major in charge of the guest worker program to ensure that they could attend school on some of the weekdays. For that, and for many other reasons, I was known as a Haji lover. The thing that I want to remember the most is the most terrifying. It is now blocked out and missing. I can only remember it in the terror of my dreams. Others in my unit have confirmed the nightmare's authenticity. They have told me that it is better not to remember. So I wake up at 1 a.m. and sit, looking into the broken mirror of my memory, trying to find the missing piece. For a long time, almost a decade in fact, I had no idea where the dream had come from. 3 soldiers had died, and I had forgotten somehow. I started drinking again after the fragments of my memory were confirmed by others who had been there. Even as I write this, I feel as if I am still stuck in the sandstorm, or perhaps trapped in an hourglass. How will I write the end before the sand covers me?
Wow, yeah. Did you write before you started writing your book?
No. No, not at all.
It's incredible, man. It's very articulate. It's very, paints a lot of imagery. Just listening to that, it's very powerful stuff. And are you writing anything else after this, you think, or is this it?
I'm working on a few projects. They're in their early stages. I'm thinking about a novel right now. So I have a few pages of that I'm kind of working on. So
cool. So it's become something more for you than just expression, just getting it out for yourself. It's become more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly has. And while I don't care if I'm ever a famous author, I like Franz Kafka's attitude. And Kafka didn't care if he ever became a famous writer. He thought fame was unimportant. What I really care about is someone finding the book in 100 years and maybe republishing it. After I'm long dead, anyone can say whatever they want about it. But I would ask you and everyone listening, please go pick up a copy. It would mean the world to me just to have it, well, in your case, in Canada, in another country. I would love to have my book in another country, but I would ask anyone listening just to pick it up, give it a try. It's very reasonably priced, and it's truly my life's work. So I would implore everyone to pick it up.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Thanks again, Joe. And thanks for reading that out. That was great to listen to.
You're so welcome. It's been my pleasure. And thank you so much for having me.
You have anywhere else? You know, obviously, we'll direct people to your book. Do you have anywhere else to direct people, social media or anything like that?
Follow me, JoeSoul2 on Twitter, @JoeSoel2.
Awesome. Thanks, Joe.